You're listening to the Sound Atlas.
Check two, one, two, check two.
Are you going to talk that soft?
That's my radio voice.
That's your radio. You're trying to pick up dates today, huh? Okay. Tommy Starr hanging out with you on the Sound Atlas. And let's try that again. Tommy Starr hanging out with you on the Sound Atlas. And in the studio tonight, today, this evening, whatever you want to call it, we have Jared England. Hello, Jared.
Hello, Tommy.
How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing awesome. Couldn't be better.
Yeah. So we're going to talk to you a little bit this evening about music and, I don't know, maybe cars or, you know, whatever your pleasure is. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's kind of let people know a little bit, background, a few bands they may have. Hey, I know that band. That's that dude. Some bands you've been in through the years, Jared England.
Of course, currently Black Mountain Prophet. Temporarily Screaming Cheetah Willies, back in the day, Rufus Huff, our real, real early days, Jacob's Climb, with Paul Hatchett. Paul plays with Fat Box.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, weren't you in a band before Rufus Huff? For some reason, I'm thinking had Blue or Venus in there?
Blues Child.
Blues Child!
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of on the right track.
That was myself, Chris... And Chris brought Dean into it and Brad Masden. And then it later turned into Dean, Chris, myself, and Greg, and that was Rufus Huff.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say Chris and Dean, you mean Chris Hardesty?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris Hardesty. Yeah, yeah, and Dean Smith.
Yeah, yeah. We got to make sure, because, you know, there's a lot of Chris's and Dean's out there.
You're right.
Yeah, but we're talking about the Chris and the Dean.
The Chris Hardesty.
That's right. So Blues Child was the name of that band. I think that's the first time that I ever saw you on stage. Maybe State Street Pub. What year was all that going on?
Oh, golly. What's this year?
This year is 2018.
Let's see. Seems like the Huff formed in 08. You'd have to ask Eric Martin. Mm-hmm. He would know.
Yeah. I'm thinking the Huff was even before that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because that's what it... that's what it evolved into was the Huff, but I think it might have been 2006 when we first started, because I hadn't played in 7 years prior to that. And then we formed Blues Child, and then the drummer we had, Mike Cherry, I think, didn't work out, and I pulled Chris in, and then Chris pulled Dean in, and then next thing you know, it's 2008 and we're doing the Huff.
That's right. So did you guys release anything, Blues Child? Did you guys go in the studio?
No.
All original, all covers? What was it?
No, we... I like to take the old obscure songs and do my own versions of them.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I'm Ready is on the first Black Mountain Prophet album.
Mm-hmm.
We were a heavier blues band. We did a lot of covers. We did some originals. And then the originals later on kind of made themselves into Rufus Huff, too. Because,
mm-hmm.
You know, Chris and I have always written together. I mean, Chris and I have written many songs on the Rufus Huff album and on the first... or the second Black Mountain Prophet album.
Now, we're going to be talking definitely about Black Mountain Prophet, the two albums, formation of the band,
mm-hmm.
who the band is, mm-hmm. Where, why, how the band you know, puts together, you guys record, why you don't hit the road, you know, all that good stuff, because I'm curious about that. High school, is that when you started getting into all this stuff?
Yeah, I was in a band in high school called Tantrum, like Temper Tantrum.
Mm-hmm.
And it fit us all because we all had our occasional tantrums. But, and then after, Tantrum was a guy named Steve Jesse, a guy named Bobby Hedrick, and myself. And then my brother also had a band called Panster. And that was my brother and a guy named Todd Coop and maybe a Randy Rains. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, man, we're talking about 1984, 85. I mean, golly, mm-hmm. I was 14 maybe. But So my brother and I put together a band, or my brother actually had a band, that band Panster, and then we formed a band called the Jimtown Gang. Mm-hmm. And I believe that was me, my brother, Steve Jesse again, Richard Thomerson, they called him Fleabag, a good old boy named Mark Shipley, and that's Andy Wells' brother-in-law. And then Steve left the band, and a guy named Bobby Polson, remember Bobby?
Mm-hmm.
He got on drums with us. And then after that, I went to a band with a real good guy named Eric Bowman, Paul Hatchett, and myself. And there were so many different variations of that band, Jacob's Climb. I mean, we played right over there many nights.
Now, see, I've heard of Jacob's Climb.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That was, that was probably the first band. I think I was maybe 15 and I played over here at Picasso's.
Mm-hmm.
And
wait a minute, you're 15, you play Picasso's? Was it one of those deals where they sneak you in the back door, you do your set and you sneak back out the back door?
Yeah, I mean, Kenny, man, what did they call Ken Smith's what I call Kenny.
Uh-huh.
I don't call him Kenny Lee, you're Ken Smith.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the times, some of my relatives would take care of things over there when they got out of hand.
Okay.
And
what do you mean exactly by that?
I've heard so many
big old boys.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's some big old boys.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if I should say it or not, but well, let's just get to the Ken let us in to play.
Uh-huh.
Now, there was a band back then called Black Cat Bone.
Uh-huh. Know that band.
And Paul Hatchett was real good friends with those guys, Johnny and David, and I think it was Mark Hendricks, maybe. Is that mm-hmm. right?
That's correct.
And so anytime they would play on there, they'd always get us to go over there. You know,
uh-huh.
We didn't know what we were doing, but
have you come open the show?
Oh, yeah, a lot of times. Matter of fact, we did an interview in here one night right before we played. This is like 1987, maybe, 88, uh-huh. something like that. It might have been later than that, but I just remember being so nervous. It's like, Paul's like, hey, man, the radio station wants to interview us over there. And I'm like, you know, what am I, 15, 16 years old?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but anyway, and after that, you know, of course, I had a beard when I was 7, so... But Kenny Lee, Ken Smith, after that, would always let us in over there to play.
I mean,
and it was years later, Ken, I went over there years later, and I met Ken in there, and I said, man, I'm celebrating my 21st birthday.
Yeah.
He said, what? I said, yeah. He said, you mean you've been playing in here all these years, and you're not listening now? Don't act like you care. But anyway, the Jacob's Climb band, who was I with after that? Of course, I quit for years after that. I would go and jam with people, but then I met my wife and I got married to Christy, and I just decided I wasn't going to do none of the music no more.
Mm-hmm.
And then... you know, when you got something like that, that's a part of you, and it's not there. The people that's closest to you and love you the most, I think, are the first to notice it.
Uh huh. So they were like, something's missing. Why aren't you doing that music thing that you like so much?
Yeah, and she told me. She said, and I was trying to change. I mean, I'm not going to say what all I was trying to change from, but I was, you know, trying to start over and be a new guy. And,
mm-hmm.
and one day she just, I remember specifically, I was sitting in the living room and she come in there. I had a guitar in my hand. I was playing it. And she said, you need to get back out and start playing music again.
Mm-hmm.
And within 30 seconds, I made 3 or 4 phone calls and Blues Child was having their first rehearsal, and I think it was 2 weeks after that we were out. You know, yeah. That's all I needed to be shot out of that slingshot.
Yeah. So you had the approval of the family and you were ready to roll anyway.
Right.
And so you were like, well, I'm cool with it. They're cool with it. Let's go do it.
I know, Christy. Well, I take that back. There's something I left out. I lived with a guy for several years named Jim Zawatny, Jimmy Z.
Mm-hmm.
And we played music over there all the time. And my wife knew that I was a musician. Now, Jimmy played with Chris and Dean and John Martin.
Mm-hmm.
What was that band called?
Are you talking about the one that Greg was involved in that they went?
Greg came later, the Crackers.
Crackers, yeah. That's not
but
who you're talking about.
But there was a band before. Right, you see how Blues Child formed into Rufus Huff.
Uh-huh.
The band that John and Jimmy and Dean and Chris and all those guys were in, Brad Mazden may have been in it, it ended up forming into the Crackers.
I see.
Oops.
That's perfect.
That was
how your
Bob
phone,
Watkins.
Your phone made that sound.
Yeah, ding, now I remember.
Your brain's kicking in, yeah.
What was it? The Hoodoo Brothers.
Yeah.
That's right, right?
I remember that
Isn't
band.
That right? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, now, and...
Well, there's a lot of puzzle pieces here. You're trying to put them together as best
yeah,
you can.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of sales broke. I mean, a lot of pieces, puzzle pieces lost there. But anyway, I met my wife while I was living there with Jimmy. And I give Jimmy Z a big shout out for, he was the one that introduced me to the blues and turned me into all that. And I was listening to the blues before I really even knew who it was or who I was listening to. But Jimmy was the one that he had all the blues records, man. I mean, golly, a wall full of them and really got me on track. You know, what I think music is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And, anyway, that was a whole different lifestyle over there. I won't get into that.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy's an awesome guy. Great guy. I love him today. Don't have anything bad I'll say about Z. He saved my life and I saved his.
That's good.
But when I met Christy, I was done with everything. I was going to focus on my wife.
You were trying to kind of so I went and did that. My past is my past. I need mm-hmm. to straighten up a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe you have some stuff going on in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You met somebody you cared about. You thought, you know what? I need to get myself straight. This is something special here. I need to do it right.
You've interviewed a lot of rock and rollers, haven't you?
I've interviewed a few, but that's okay. I mean, that's what life's all about, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
Either you don't go down a path because you've seen what it does to other people, or you go down that path and go, wow, this is not exactly what I thought it might be, and so you go, you know what? I've learned my lesson. I'm going to go back over this way and be all good.
That's right.
And that's good.
That's
because
exactly
those
right.
that don't go back, those the ones that keep going down that path that end up in a bad situation and usually taking most of the family and friends with them. Yeah,
everybody goes down the drain.
That's right,
clockwise.
That's right. So but, let me ask you this, are you from Bowling Green?
No, I'm from Barron County.
Barron County,
Glasgow.
Okay. Now you obviously spend a lot of time in the Bowling Green area if you're over here going to Picasso's at 15.
Yeah, I
so
mean,
you're just cruising over here with your buddies.
We all knew where the scene was.
Yeah.
Yeah, there wasn't much going on up there. I mean, man, a lot of great, awesome musicians come out of that water up there.
But, oh, boy, you don't have to tell me. You got that right.
I mean, golly, great musicians. I mean, you know them. I know them.
Yeah.
But, but we all knew, you know. There were certain places up there to play. Seems like there was a tobacco warehouse up there that mm-hmm. a lot of good bands would go to. I remember seeing, I don't remember if it was Bates Motel or Black Cat Bone down there.
Mm-hmm.
I rode my 10-speed out there once to see Itchy Brother. I don't remember if it was Greg playing or James Harrison,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
there was, they tried to get all the music they could in up there, but, we all knew Bowling Green was the closest place for us to hit. And Picasso's was, that was the place that I wanted to play.
Big time happening at that time.
Yeah, it was awesome. And when I was in, the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th grade. Man, that's all everybody talked about was playing Picasso.
Of course. And they had a lot of great acts that came through there.
Yeah, you got that
right. Yeah, not just bands from around our area playing there, mm-hmm. but they had a lot of national acts mm-hmm. that were coming through there. Mm-hmm. Now, who were some bands that you were in? Not necessarily local. They could be local, but just bands, period. International bands, local bands, whatever. What were you into growing up music-wise? What was you like, man, I saw this band on TV so-and-so, and I got to go get their record today?
I'm a little, it seems like there's something always different about the way I approach things or went about things. I mean, still today, I'm like, oh, well, there I am. I'm the different one. But the first band that I ever saw in concert was Newgrass Revival. Mm. And I saw him at the Plaza in Glasgow with a buddy of mine, Bobby Hedrick. And the reason that I wanted to go see him was because my brother, I think it was the Commonwealth album he had. And I'm not sure if I was in the first grade then when I first heard that record or not, but I loved it. Mm-hmm. I was like, whoever that is singing sings like an angel. You know, I may have not even known what an angel was, but mm-hmm. I knew that John Cowan was who I wanted to sing like at mm-hmm. that time.
Yeah.
He was the, you know, I mean, he, I still love to hear him sing today. When I grew up, when I was growing up, my my mother had like a 53 Seberg jukebox. And I remember this jukebox from the time I was probably 2-3 years old. I mean, just real early. And I remember hearing Buddy Holly on there. And I remember hearing Elvis. And I remember the first time, I'll never forget, I pushed E1. And Mississippi Queen came on. And I was like, oh, my God, what is that? And then E2 would have been the flip side of Mississippi Queen. What is it? Something Farm?
I know. I know. Yeah. Yeah.
And then E3 was the Hollies, Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress. And I wore E1 and E3 out. I've still got the jukebox today. And my mother had an unbelievable collection of 45s. So my head would come to the speaker, and I had to reach 3 foot up in the air to find those numbers. I mean, this thing was like giant.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm 6 inches taller than it is now. But Tom T. Hall, George Jones, Waylon Jennings, that's kind of stuff that I grew up, all that stuff, listening to Elvis.
Very Buddy eclectic.
Holly. Yeah. Uh-huh. Bebopaloo. I mean, just, you know, that type stuff. I would always skip the Beatles to hear the Stones.
I do that myself.
And then later on, when I got a little older, my brother, Charlie, he's 7 years older than me. So, you know, he was discovering the rock and roll before me. And then I heard Lynyrd Skynyrd for the first time. And then I heard Montrose. I remember hearing AC/DC, and you know, when I've got these headphones on and I've got it blasting in my ears, and I'm thinking, man, I don't know what this is, but I love it. And I remember before school, we were all on our way back from Florida one day, and my mom, she's sitting up in the front seat, and she's like, Kim, my sister, she says, well, what are you going to be when you grow up? And she said, and they asked my brother, you know, and then it, you know, went around and finally got to me, and Lynyrd Skynyrd's plane had crashed, and they were showing a full concert of Lynyrd Skynyrd there in Florida, wherever we was. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching that on this big screen. It's just like being at the concert. And I told her, I said, I'm quitting school. I'm growing my hair out. I'm going to be a rock and roller.
That should be a bumper sticker.
Well, and to this day, that's, you know, that's what I've, I mean, that's what I consider myself. Mm-hmm. My day job's my side job. But after that, I remember somewhere around 85, I found this cassette tape and I listened to it for years and years and years. And then when I moved in with Z, like I said earlier, Jimmy Z, Jimmy was the only guy I knew that had the internet. Mm-hmm. And I said, man, you need to hear this cassette. I need to know who this is. I said, because this is where I go to. You know, when I want to forget all this other stuff I listen to, I put this tape in.
So you had a tape, but you had no idea who it was.
No name on it.
Yeah.
And he stuck it in, and the first thing he said, well, man, he said, that's Muddy Waters. And I said, okay. And so he turned it over, and he didn't recognize it. So we started taking lyrics from the songs and punching them into the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And we came up with, the band was called King Biscuit Boy with Crowbar, and Richard Newell was the singer.
Hmm.
And today, that, if somebody was to ask me, who is your favorite band to listen to, it's King Biscuit Boy with Crowbar. Keith Richards said that Richard Newell was the Canadian version of Muddy Waters.
Hmm.
And sometimes I wondered if the guy on the second side of the cassette tape wasn't the guy on the first side.
Mm-hmm.
And then it ends up, He's a white guy from Canada.
Yeah.
Richard Newell. And man, whenever I found out who that was, I was ordering CDs right and left. And still today, I mean, when I want to hear something, and I want to get away from all the other racket, I put in King Biscuit Boy.
So that is your number one of all time, if you had to pick one.
Yeah. That'd be it, because they were so reckless. You know, I like the Stones. I always chose the Stones over the Beatles. I don't know why people put those two in the same category, but the Stones always had this reckless sound about them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I always liked. I liked that. I don't want to call the Stones sloppy, because they wasn't, but in a way, to my ear, it's a sloppy kind of...
Mm-hmm.
And
it's like,
and
somebody said they plug in and somebody say go, and they just go.
Yeah, guitar might be out of tune, or whatever. But that's the way that the King Biscuit Boy and the Crowbar guys were. I mean, if Richard was hoarse, man, they're still going at it. If an amp was blowed, they're going at it. If a string broke, they're going at it.
We're going until either the power's cut, then we're gonna be an acoustic act, mm-hmm. whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm. And that's you know, and for years I'd preach everybody, man, you got to listen to King Biscuit Boy. You got to listen to King Biscuit. Now, back in high school, I was preaching Montrose. You got to listen to Montrose. You got to listen to Montrose.
It's good to stretch out, though.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, and back then there wasn't any internet and all that stuff. And it was a lot harder to find. And the only way you could get somebody to listen to what you were listening to, hey, man, come on over later, and we're going to put an album on,
sure.
and, you know, get out the bong, and we're going to experience Ronnie Montrose.
Or a puzzle, whatever they're into.
I meant a puzzle.
Yeah, that's what you meant to say puzzle.
But, that's pretty much, I like Johnny Winter. I like Billy Gibbons. I've always loved listening to those guys, but when I got to go back home, mm-hmm. it's to King Biscuit Boy. And a lot of people's going, who the crap's King Biscuit? Well, I urge you to go check it out if you want to hear some good blues.
Well, see, that's cool though, because it's really cool to discover something new and to kind of check out something that somebody else is into,
right.
because we all like a lot of the same, but you know, usually everybody's got one or two that's a little off the path a little bit, and that's a good way to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's great that you brought that up, but I'm going to ask you one last question about that. Do you still have that tape?
Oh yeah, I've got the cassette.
You still got the original cassette?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you got to keep that forever.
I have got a lot of cassettes.
Uh-huh.
I've got a lot of stuff. But no, I don't have a cassette player,
uh-huh.
but no, I've still got the cassette.
Yeah, you probably have those songs on a CD or downloaded or something these days.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was able to find one of the CDs. And then as the internet grew, people started, I guess, putting things on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
and making records available, and you know, the whole deal. And now you can get a lot of that King Biscuit Boy. I ordered a lot of it through the mail.
Mm-hmm. What's the one song? If somebody's going, I want to pick out one song, find me one song. What song do they need? Go find this one and give it a listen.
Of King Biscuit?
Yeah.
Biscuits Boogie.
All right. Biscuits Boogie. There you go. King Biscuit Boy.
That's the right answer.
I know it. It's like it's your phone, but it's not. It's your brain kicking in, man.
I thought it was my phone.
Sound effects.
Now, Biscuits Boogie.
Mm-hmm.
Slow Blues. Golly, I don't know, man. They got so many. I don't.
We're going to start with Biscuits Boogie.
That'd be the one.
Yeah. We want to talk a little bit about Rufus Huff.
Okay.
Tell us again how that came about. You say that the Blues Child, and then you guys kind of morphed into Rufus Huff. You brought Greg in. What happened there?
Well, you know, I don't know what everybody else's feelings were about. Mm-hmm. There was something about Greg, Dean, and Chris. They had a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's with the Crackers. Mm-hmm. And that's real early. That's way before the Hove.
Early 90s. Like 92, 93, I think. I'm pretty sure I'm right on that.
It wasn't long. I mean, it wasn't long after the Headhunters, you know, split the airway or whatever. But,
so they were playing together in the Crackers for a while there. Of course, that eventually kind of did its thing.
Right. And I thought they were great. I think John Martin's an awesome singer.
Great singer, great player.
Great singer,
good
great
guy.
Player, great guy. Yeah. I mean, just all the way around. I mean, I think the world of John.
Yeah.
And John was a good friend of Jimmy Z, the guy. Actually, John lived with Jimmy Z for a while, you know, because they were in the Hoodoo Brothers, and that's where I met John. Blues Child did. We played at some kind of festival somewhere. I don't even remember where it was. And Chris Harstey was there playing with somebody. And I don't remember. Chris can tell you. Chris told me when I was 14, he said, one day me and you will play together. I'm like, get out of here, punk. But anyway, he can tell you about that. So he saw me. He said he saw me at Picasso's. But anyway, back to what I was saying. The Blues Child was playing somewhere. And we were having drummer problems, and Brad says, man, I know this guy, Chris Hardesty. He said, that guy's standing over there. And I looked, I said, man, I know him. I've talked to him several times. He's a real cool guy. I said, if I remember right, I think he played with Superfuzz. And Brad's Superfuzz. And Brad said, yeah, that's him. So Brad yells at Chris, and Chris turns around, and Chris comes walking up, and Brad says, hey, man, I got a question I want to ask you. And Blues Child had just come off stage, and Brad said, Chris, he said, I got a question for you. And Chris said, yes, I'll do it. And I'm looking at Brad. He said, well, I haven't even asked you yet. And Chris said, I'll do it. And so it ends up being Chris on drums. I'm singing, of course, and I was playing guitar. Brad's playing guitar, and we had a guy named Mark Welch on bass, and Mark played in a band from Allen County called Ding High Tide. And Welch was a killer bass player. I mean, an awesome bass player. And but it just wasn't working out. Mark even told me one time that it was just getting a little more bluesier than really what he wanted to do. And I'm like, that's cool, man. That's cool.
Yeah.
And Chris is back there the whole time, you know, like a dog with a ball.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get Dean. So mm-hmm. we got Dean.
Mm-hmm.
So it ends up being Brad Masden, myself, Dean, and Chris. And then, and then it ended up being, oh, me, that was a funny picture on the wall there. But anyway, it ended up being me and Greg and Dean and Chris, and they wanted to get together in the top of
Backstage Music.
How'd you know?
I just figured.
So Chris and Dean, they're like, you know, you need to check this guy out. So we got up there in the top of Backstage Music, and I bet we played for 2 hours before we ever stopped. I mean, it was a freaking jam.
It was rolling.
Man, we were into it. I got Chris got in touch with Greg. Well, I ended up getting in touch with Greg, and I said, man, you know, I said, we're going to get together on the top of backstage. Just send me 5 or 6 songs that you'd like to just, you know, jam on. Mm-hmm. And he did, and man, you're talking about a jam. Golly. I can still see the dust coming out of the ceiling up there. And I remember we got done, and Greg, he kind of looked to his left, and he looked to his right, and he's like, yeah, this is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So next thing you know, we're in the studio. We're playing shows here and there, and we're in the studio at Barracks, David Barracks. We did a record that went Zoho Records out of New York, and we put that out. And
took you guys a while to get that record, though. Seems like you were working on it for 2 or 3 years.
Well,
but I mean, Greg was busy with the Headhunters, and you guys had, you know, day gigs and all. So
here's the thing I figured out about that band: we're all procrastinators.
Yeah,
every one of us. If somebody would get out and book a Rufus Huff gig, and get us pushed, we would go out and do it. It's just nobody in that band, including myself, nobody took charge. I mean, we needed a manager worse than any band in the world needed it. And still, I think today, if there's no problems between nobody, we all love each other. We talk all the time. You
That's
know,
good.
I mean, there's no, I mean, everybody in that band went through a little deal, I think, where maybe, you know, another one band member was like, ah, that ain't cool. I did it. I did stuff in that band. It wasn't cool. We all did. Mm-hmm. But still, I think I can't say we had played so much, because I look at, you know, Greg and the Headhunters. Greg's been in that band, golly, forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, golly, you can take it on back to the Itchy Brother if you want to. I can't sit here and say, man, we just did so many songs so many times. I mean, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. We just one day it was over. Just, you know, all bands come to the end, unless you're Aerosmith and the Rolling Stones. Yeah. They all end. Everything ends. Mm-hmm. There's a reason sometimes, and there's not a reason sometimes. Yeah. But Rufus Huff, every one of us is still alive and well. Mm-hmm. And I really think if somebody other than us four just would do it, mm-hmm. it would, you know, we would get out and maybe do something. But
now, as far as music, this is off the top of my head. You guys did the little EP, which was like 4 or 5 songs. Well, 4 songs, I think.
Oh, the sounds, Rufus Huff Sound Sampler. Big Sound Sampler.
That's right.
That's what it was.
You did that one. I think you only did like 100 of them, right? Wasn't that a self kind of deal?
I have no idea.
I'm thinking about 100 of them, because you guys were putting them together here at the radio station one
night. I remember
night.
Being back there signing them or something.
Yeah, we did. You guys were on Home Cooking with me, and you guys are all on the AM in the back of the building back there, folding the covers and putting a number and putting them all together.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. And you did that. And then
had a great big old guy on the tallest man in the world.
He was like in the living room, and he was standing with his, I guess, his parents or whatever.
I think that was Dean's idea.
Yeah.
There.
Well, there's, you know, somebody out there is a Rufus Huff fan or a fan of local music here in South Central Kentucky. That's one you need to look for and get your hands on. Rufus Huff, the Big Sound Sampler, because I think really only about 100 of those. And
wasn't many.
Yeah, you did that, and then you did the full album, and somewhere in there you did the Christmas song, The Jolly Fat Man, which ended up on a compilation, but I can't think what...
You know more about that than
I do. What about that compilation? Where was that out of? Do you know what I'm talking about? It was on a CD, but I don't really recognize any other bands on. I've got that compilation.
Oh, it was on something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't have that.
Yeah. Well, it was on something. And then you guys did the J.J. Cale deal with Zoho.
God, I forgot about that.
Well, there was Volume 1 and Volume 2, where one was vocal, one was just instrumental. Mm-hmm. So I think that was kind of like the last thing you guys did, right?
Yeah, we did Crazy Mama and Cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the Rufus Huff CD not only released here in the States, but there is a UK issue.
Yeah, now that's the only copy I've got. It's the UK.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I've got that. But I think I've got. I'll tell you what happened. I've got the original Rufus Huff CD box and cover and all that, but I had a vehicle. That had a CD player in it, and it wouldn't eject the CD. And so my wife got hit in that car, and it totaled it, and the CD stayed with it. So. Yeah.
So you have the U.S. Distribution, whatever you want to call it, the domestic issue of it on CD, but no disc. And then you have the full CD UK.
You're right. That's the one where we're standing in the field.
Yeah, on the back.
Looking at the church.
Yeah. The cover art's a little bit different. I think, the packaging all over is a little bit different. But the track listing, I believe, is the same.
The track listing's the same. And if I remember right, those were the pictures. I think now you may ask Dean about that, but I think the pictures on that CD was the ones we originally wanted on the American release.
Oh, really?
I'm pretty sure, because I'm thinking we wasn't really into the pictures that was on the,
you guys are like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Yeah, it was the other ones that we liked, but now, what was his name? Julie, Gene's wife, Julie, her son, I think Barrett's the one that made those pictures. And we had some really cool pictures.
Well, yeah, there's some great photos. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they're really nice.
Mm-hmm. But I like that you're, I was like, this is what it's all about right here.
Yeah, how did you get that? Did they get you a copy or did you buy it from somewhere?
Golly, man, I don't know.
Cause I have one, but I actually had to order it from the UK. I had to pay full price, man.
Greg could tell you, but I think somebody had sent, I think Zoho sent some of them.
Yeah.
And of course, we would be able to, you know.
Get a couple for yourself, sure.
Yeah, and I got one out of it. And
so what did you think about going in the studio at Barracks and doing that Rufus Huff CD, that whole experience?
It didn't matter where we were at or what we were doing. When we went in to make music, we made it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'd be making words up right out of my head, you know, and I mean, we would be creating songs on the spot. And I remember going into the studio up at Barracks for the first time, and Greg was off in a room somewhere doing something, eating chili or something. and
probably barbecue.
Chili and pork rinds. And Dean and Chris and I were in there, and David Barracks sitting there, and he's like, well, what do y'all want to do? And we didn't know what we were going to do. We're here, you know. And I had some ideas what I wanted to do.
Well, you had some songs. You had something ready. You didn't just walk in, right?
We went in there, and I said, hey, let's do that song called Superstitious. And Dean's like, you mean that Stevie Wonder song? I'm like, no, man. I ain't superstitious. I ain't superstitious. And so we went in there, and you may have to talk to them and get this story straight. But from what I remember, they went in there, they worked up a beginning to that song, and then they worked up an ending.
Uh huh.
And everything in between's a jam. And we went in there and recorded that sucker, I think, in one take.
Uh huh.
And I put down the vocals, so we go in there and listen to it, and David Barracks going, oh, my God. And everybody's like, oh, God, this is awesome. And I'm like, let's do another one. So we go in again. I'm on the internet getting the words to Ain't Superstitious. I don't even know them. And then we go do Good Morning, Little Schoolgirl. Was that on that record?
Yeah.
It was on the Rufus Huff record.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So,
I think it was on both, wasn't it? Wasn't it on
I don't know.
Well, anyway, it's on something.
I remember we recorded, and I think it's on that record.
Yeah.
And I got the words off of, is Good Morning Little Schoolgirl on that? Anyway.
You guys recorded it.
Yeah. And and I get the words off the internet there, and we go in, and I mean, man, we freaking, and I'm like, y'all have played this before. They'd never played it before.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we're all like, if it's going to work like this, and I think that's what really lit a fire under Greg's tail. We end up at my house in my studio, or my jam room, studio, music room, whatever you call it. And we were like, we're freaking doing a record. We've got two recorded, you know, and I'm thinking we need like 8 more, 9 more. So we ended up writing, I think the first song, and the reason we called it Haint instead of Ain't was because I couldn't push Ain't. I could push Haint.
Mm-hmm.
So we named it Haint No Good Life. And then we did, golly, what was that song called?
Maybe I should have brought the CD in here before we had this discussion.
But anyway, we wrote several songs over the next, I'm going to say 4 to 6, 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went back with a whole different, you know, we was like, this is going to rock.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed a couple more songs after we did those, and Greg brought a few in. We did them, and then the next thing I know, Greg's fishing around for labels, and I think he had, you know, a few different labels, but we ended up going with Zoho.
Mm-hmm.
But to the original question, how did I feel about all that? The experience, I mean, it was. Man, that's right where I needed to be, mm-hmm. where I knew. I was 36 years old.
Yeah.
I'm 47 years old now. You know, yeah. I remember I used to say when I was a kid, when I was a little bitty kid, you know, first grade, I'd be praying at night, and I'd go, God, I want to be a rock and roll star one day. But if I get to 36, I'm giving it up. Well,
was that part of the deal?
That was the prayer I'd always say. I always thought, man, 36 is old, and I'm not doing it after 36. And I'm talking first grade. I'm thinking about this stuff. You know, uh-huh. I've had this, and I knew where I was going from day one. But I remember 36 years old, you know, came, and I'm like, next thing I know, I'm in the studio.
Yeah.
We're in there making a rock and roll record,
uh-huh.
and a mighty fine one.
Yeah.
But I really felt comfortable being in there and doing the whole thing because, I mean, that's what I was meant to do.
Yeah.
And Greg was always easy to work with. Dean, Chris, there was never, nobody ever argued in that band. No, there was never, you know, I mean, we all got along. You know, I've been in a lot of bands.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're saying a lot of professionalism, a lot of respect for each other.
Exactly.
Giving each other room mm-hmm. to experiment a little bit.
Mm-hmm. That's the way Black Mountain Prophet is. We've been together since 2009, I think. Well, when I took Mike's place in the Cheetah Wheelies.
Yeah. Well, that's where I was going to go next, because after Rufus Huff, you had a little minute there where I remember you came up here one time and it seemed like you had a track or two that you guys were working on.
I think we did... We did a Waylon Jennings song that we recorded. Heads did it. Everybody knows you've been stepping on my. I got the only day that I walked the line. We did that. We did a song called "The Monkey."
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it was called.
Surely, folks know who the Screaming Cheetah Wheelies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't look them up.
Yeah, exactly.
They had they were happening for a minute there, mm-hmm. and I guess that was like the early 90s, mm-hmm. early to mid 90s. They mm-hmm. had a couple mm-hmm. of songs that were moving pretty good.
I think they were on Sony Records, and matter of fact, Mike just won a Grammy here just a couple of years ago.
Nice.
For American Roots or something like mm-hmm. that, Roots record. But
so what happened with that? I mean, were they trying to get that band back together? Was that band together? Did they say, hey, let's reform the band, but we need a new singer? I mean, what exactly, how did that, the whole deal, what happened there?
Mike quit for reasons, you know, that's between them.
Yeah, sure.
And Brody, their sound man, their engineer, you know, their silent member,
mm-hmm.
Hutchison, he's, you know, they, you know, when somebody like Mike Ferris leaves your band, you know, that's like David Lee Roth leaving Van Halen.
Sure.
What the crap are we going to do?
Powerful personality, crazy mm-hmm. good voice. Yeah.
And Brody knew Dean and Chris from the Superfuzz days. And they got Brody to start running sound for us because Brody had just left Government Mule. Brody had been with Government Mule for like 7 years. Mm-hmm. And Brody's been with everybody. And love him to death. And so Brody starts running sound for us. And he's like, hey, man. He said, how would you feel about coming down to Nashville and doing a record with the Screaming Chitawili? And I'm like, sure. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll do that. I may have today, if I had that to do all over again, I may have thought about it twice. Mm-hmm. For several reasons. Not for me, for other people. Number one, if anybody ever replaces me in Rufus Huff, there's going to be a backroom discussion or an alley fight. But I thought about that when I was fronting Screaming Chitawillies. We had several shows, and I remember the first two was we played here in Bowling Green. The first show, that was at, what's the club right up there called? The big club, everybody.
Tidballs?
Tidballs. Mm-hmm. We played there. And then the next night we played, I think it's the Exit Inn. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't. It was Mercy Lounge. Mm-hmm. And people were flying in from everywhere. I mean, Canada, New York, New Jersey. I mean, people came from everywhere down there to see that show. Mm-hmm. But I remember thinking, I don't feel right taking this guy's spot. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to do that. So we did two shows. Some real loyal fans was happy. And we ended it there, and we formed Black Mountain Prophet. And guitar player for Screaming Chitawillies, Rick White, he ended up moving to Knoxville. Terry ended up going into the Army or the Air Force or something. And so really, it was Bob and Steve Burgess, Bob Watkins and Steve Burgess and I were the three left out of that reformed Screaming Chitawilly group. And so I'm thinking, let's just do something new and fresh. Mm-hmm. We formed Black Mountain Prophet. We put out that first record, Notorious Sinner. We had several different musicians on that album. I think we had five drummers on there, including me. I played drums on three or four tracks, played bass on three or four tracks.
So is Black Mountain Prophet kind of a revolving door of musicians? Are there a couple that are... Are you the only stable member of that band that put together?
That first album, Notorious Sinner, had the band that is today on it. But so many... There was... All I know, all I wanted to do, Brody and I, was put out a record with me on it. That's what we wanted to do, and we wanted Bob in on it, and we wanted Steve. If a drummer didn't show up that day, we had four other drummers, including myself, we could call in, and we put it out. And we ended up with a real cool rhythm section, Thomas and Riley Wingate, and they ended up doing, and they were like 17 and 18 years old.
Yeah, I remember. I
mean, they did some of the cool, some of the more... what do you call it? What kind of band do you consider Rush and...
Progressive?
Right. They were more progressive. Mm-hmm. And they did more of the progressive songs on that, like Smack Me Down, mm-hmm. and those type songs.
Smack Me Down may be my favorite from that first album. Yeah, I like Deuteronomy a lot. They're both really good albums.
Deuteronomy was our tribute to Lane. And, you know, a lot of people's, even the people at the record company at Grooveyard was like, man, this sounds an awful lot like Alice in Chains. And I'm like, you know I preach the blues and Buddy Holly and Elvis, but I'm a Alice in Chains freak. Mm-hmm. I love that band. A lot of those other bands from that era, most of them I never listened to, but I heard him sing one time and I was like, everything that is wrong about what this guy's doing, I love. But anyway, we did Deuteronomy, and I think the boys played on that record too, the Wingate Boys. But mm-hmm. There were several different musicians on that record. And then the second record, Chris Hardesty had heard the first record. And he said, man, I want to do that next record. Mm-hmm. I said, well, okay, you're in. So it was Chris, Bob, myself, and we had tried out so many bass players, and I had a real good friend that I used to give guitar lessons to, and he used to come over and jam with us when I lived with Jimmy Z, Brian Whitty. And Brian would come down there and listen to us record, and Brian's a good guitar player. And I said, man, can you want to pick up the bass and play a little bass? So anyway, he played the bass on Tales from the South, the second record. So that's myself, Bob, Chris, and Brian. And that record went on Zoho Records. Mm-hmm. And then...
So you guys are still with Zoho, still...
Did I say so? I meant Grooveyard.
Yeah, it's, I was thinking Grooveyard. It was Grooveyard. Yeah,
yeah, Grooveyard.
Yeah.
And it, you know more about this stuff than I do. And then, so we end up on this next record that we're fixing to start doing. We're going to start writing rehearsals here soon. Now, we're going to get together and rehearse next Friday. Mm-hmm. But the band right now is... Bobby Watkins of the Screaming Cheetah Wheelies. We've brought Steve Burgess back in from the Screaming Cheetah Wheelies on bass. Chris Hardesty's on drums. Brian Whitty's moved from bass to guitar, and I'm on guitar and vocals. Mm-hmm. And we've got a real well-known piano player, keyboard player that we're probably going to invite in the next few weeks, but I don't want to say who that is just yet.
So those out there, let me just make sure I get this out here. Black Mountain Prophet. Mm-hmm. Folks want to know what you're doing right now. Jump on the internet, punch in Black Mountain Prophet. I'm sure both CDs are still available. The first release in 2013? The second released in 2016? You guys are looking to maybe get something out in 2019. Where can they get those CDs?
Let me think now. I know you can get them at Amazon, CD Baby, Grooveyard Records. I think that's www.grooveyardrecords.com. Mm-hmm. I think Melomats may have some. Of course, I mean, you can listen to it on, it's all over YouTube. And what's some of those? A Pandora? And
they just punch it in and probably they can, come up.
You can find it.
Yeah.
And the first record we call the Orange Album. It's Notorious Sinner. and that's a picture of Bob Watkins and I fighting on the mountain. And then the second album's Tales from the South. We call that the White Album.
Okay. The Orange Album and the White Album. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of off-white, really.
Yeah.
It's more tan.
Yeah. Yeah. Got the two little kids on there.
Yeah.
He's wooing his girlfriend there on the porch.
Now we're just about ready to wrap it up. We're going to cut you loose because I think we've covered just about your entire musical career. We didn't mention Mountain of Love, but we'll let them look that one up. go find some Mountain of Love, and you'll find some folks on there you recognize too. But that's some of that UK stuff. So we're going to leave that one for them to solve the puzzle on that one right there. Right. Let's talk for a few minutes about cars, and we're going to let it go. Now, you're all about some cars, aren't you?
Yeah.
How'd you get into cars?
Well, I bought my first 55 Chevrolet when I was 12.
What?
Yeah.
What kind of mowing the yard kind of job did you have that you it, on it, a 55?
Nah, it wasn't like that. we won't go into the whole into details right now because it's a long story, sad story. But
well, we don't want the sad part. Let's talk about the happy part a little bit.
My dad drowned when my mother was pregnant with me.
Oh,
saving my brother's life.
That is very
succeeded.
Sad. Yeah, that's very sad.
From the day I was born till I turned 18, I Social Security, drawed a check, and I was always into old hot rods and old cars. And then when I turned 12, I just loved this old black 55 Chevrolet this guy had down the road. And he picked me up from school in it one day when it was raining. And we pulled into Minute Mart so he could buy a pack of cigarettes. And a guy come out and said, man, what you take for that car? And he held up four fingers, and I saw him. So when I got home, I told my mom, I said, Richard down the road, he priced that car today for $4,000. She said, won't you ride down there on your 10-speed and tell him you'll give him $3,600? I said, I already did. And she said, well, what'd he say? And he said, yeah. And he'd take that. So, but he thought I was full of crap, which I am. But, he
12-year-old,
thought.
12-year-old, yeah.
And so I, you know, wrote out a check. My mother did. And took it down there to him, and he had the car up there in like 15 minutes. It was a black two-door hardtop, M22 Rock Crusher, four-speed, 411 gears. It had a 302. It was a Z28. The guy that built the car, Joe Mutter, took a wreck 69 Z28 and built this 55 with the drivetrain. So fast forward up to 2018, I've had, I don't know how many 55, 6, 7s, Novas, Camaros, Chevelles. I mean, I'm, matter of fact, I've got two 55s now and a 65 short bed pickup truck.
So do you just get them, fix them up, resell them?
I get them and fix them up. I do all the body work and paint and all that stuff on them, and a lot of the interior and most of the mechanical. And I just drive them, and people, you know, they'll come up, hey, what do you take for that? And I'll price it and,
yeah,
you know, and sell it.
Just like that.
Mm-hmm. I had a couple cars in Carcraft magazine. That's when I flew to California and did that record with, who's the fretless bass player, played with the Firm?
Oh, Franklin, Tony Franklin.
Tony Franklin. Yeah, he was on that record, and me and the guy that just did the Vet Jam here a while back, sung Stranglehold.
Eric St. Holmes.
Yeah, we did a record with the editor of Popular Hot Rod, and he flew me to California. And,
to do the record.
Yeah, and we were all on that record.
Yeah.
And
are you on this full album, or are you like a guest vocalist?
I think we did three songs.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Well, see, I need to find that because I don't have that, and I'd like to have that.
Chris Duarte's on it. I got turned on to a whole new car world after that. Matter of fact, the editor, Johnny Hunkins, and golly, man, I'm so burnt. Who's the blues guitar player? Plays a lot like Stevie Ray Vaughan. Married Mel Gibson's daughter, Kenny Wayne.
Kenny Wayne Shepherd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Johnny and Kenny Wayne are best friends. I mean, they're best friends. And,
yeah.
And got to learn a lot about those guys while I was there. And, mm-hmm. And he's a big car guy, Kenny Wayne is.
Yeah, he is. Do you still have that 55?
Yeah, I've got two now.
Do you still have the 55?
No, I don't have it.
That's gone.
I know where it's at, and yeah. I know the guy that's got it.
Yeah.
And I probably got first chance at it, but, I found out that the cars I build myself, like the 55 I'm building now, it mm-hmm. came in as a frame and a body, and that's it. Nothing. No wiring, no gas lines, brake lines, engine, interior glass, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've built this car from nothing. And it's a real close race as to what's more important to me, the first car that I ever bought or the one that I've, you know, worked on every yeah. day for the past few years. So, I don't know.
What's your favorite car? Not the favorite one you own, but like... Like, for me, my favorite car is a 57 Chevy. Never owned one, never driven one, but they've been in and out of my family for years. Different folks have owned them. So, if somebody says, what's your favorite car? 57 Chevy. What's your favorite car?
My three favorite cars in this order is 1955 Chevy, 1956 Chevy, 1957 Chevy.
There we go. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's a wrap. We're going to cut you loose because I know you got a pretty lady waiting for you, man.
Yeah, you got that right.